Case number 07-1478, Conrad P. Seegers, petitioner versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Manuel for the petitioner, Mr. Pack for the respondent.
Excuse me, go ahead, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Charles Manuel for Petitioner Conrad Seegers. I understand that SEC counsel has graciously agreed to cede his argument time to distinguished counsel from the preceding case while speaking alone this morning. Today marks a first in this two-year-old administrative proceeding and appeals. Until today, neither Conrad Seegers nor anyone acting for him has ever appeared before any judge, any commissioner, any representative of the Securities and Exchange Commission to argue whether the ultimate sanction of a permanent bar as an investment advisor should be imposed. This is rather telling, and that is the crux of this appeal.
Well, didn't he make his own motion for summary disposition before the replacement ALJ?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why doesn't that... How can he now say, well, I wanted summary disposition if it went my way, but not if it went the SEC's way?
Your Honor, well, we most certainly, I feel, may plead in the alternative, and that's essentially what he was doing. It is very common in any lawsuit where one party makes a motion for summary judgment or summary disposition for the other party to make a cross motion. That doesn't mean that in the event that the other side's motion is granted, that the party making the cross motion cannot argue that the case should have been heard.
Well, it's a little different from cross motions for summary judgment, because if both parties make cross motions for summary judgment and you're the losing party, you can attack the award on the other side. There's no question about that. But in a case, in an administrative proceeding where you agree to go with summary disposition, and if he hadn't made his own motion, what if he had just simply said, well, I won't move for my own I won't make my own motion for summary disposition, but I agree with the SEC's. How is that different?
Your Honor, I think the distinction is as follows. Had the parties here agreed on a stipulation of facts and then submitted the matter to the administrative law judge on stipulated facts and cross motions for summary judgments, I agree, Your Honor, that your point would be well taken. But here it is quite different. This is, in fact, the fairly common situation where one party moves for summary judgment on his version of undisputed facts. The other party moves for summary disposition, but on a very different version of the facts.
Well, weren't the stipulated facts here what happened in district court to a large extent?
We acknowledge what happened in the district court, Your Honor, but we most certainly do not accept the findings of the district court, and most certainly not in the context of what is required here in terms of a grant of summary disposition. If you take a look at the standards for summary disposition, the rule is inherently fact-specific. What does it say? The issues that are to be tendered, as stated in SEC versus Scott, are all entirely related to the state of mind, the knowledge, the intent of the respondent. That is to say, first, the degree of scienter involved. Not just scienter, but the degree of scienter. Exactly with what intent to defraud did the respondent act? Secondly, the sincerity of the defendant's insurances against future violations. The defendant's sincerity is something that inherently requires a hearing as well. Third, the defendant's recognition of the wrongful nature of his conduct. And fourth, the degree to which the defendant's professional occupation will affect the chance of recurring violations. All of those matters are fact-specific, intent-specific, state-of-mind-specific, and they cannot be determined by summary disposition. The fact that Dr. Seegers made a cross-motion for summary disposition based on very different factual assertions, which the SEC rejected, does not mean that this case had to be determined by summary disposition. Further, this case, unlike any case cited by the SEC, involves a specific statute, a specific Supreme Court decision, and follow-on adjunct determinations by a court of appeals in that case. The SEC has focused itself on other agency decisions on very different facts, cases in which one court reported that the dispute was patently frivolous because there was a specific determination made, a clear, indisputable factual determination in the Puerto Rico aquifer case, in which the court had determined that a specific level of pollutants had been placed into the water. In Crestview, cited by the SEC, the Sixth Circuit, in fact, found that the ALJ had erred in granting summary judgment without an in-person hearing. And in Woolen Mills, a case that I believe bears Judge Henderson's signature, the court was addressing the fact that the intervener in that case, it was not the respondent in the original case that was involved, but an intervener in that case had had ample opportunity, in fact, to appear and argue and present its position in the proceeding below. Here I am in this case for the first day speaking to judges in this case. However, what is the controlling authority? Without question, it is the case of Stedman versus Securities and Exchange Commission, a case that the United States Supreme Court decided involving a hearing under the Investment Advisors Act. What the court said in Stedman is unmistakable as what I respectfully submit is controlling authority in this case. A respondent in a disciplinary proceeding is entitled to have a trial-type hearing presided over by an impartial administrative law judge, other duly appointed officer, or a commission member. The respondent may present oral or documentary evidence, cross-examine adverse witnesses, and object to the admission or exclusion of evidence, et cetera, et cetera.
But each of those, you're talking about footnote 3, right?
Yes.
Well, each of those is merely a citation to the regulations of 1980.
Yes.
Well, those are not the regulations now.
The new regulation that the SEC refers to, of course, is Rule 250. Nothing in the adoption of Rule 250, I respectfully submit, would change in any respect the determination of the Supreme Court.
But the SEC court didn't make any determination. It's just citing what rights a respondent had at that time under the regulations.
Fair comment, Judge Garland.
Right, and then under the regulation now, there is a summary disposition regulation which provides, unless there's a genuine issue of material fact, you don't have to have a hearing.
But the Supreme Court's statements in the footnote relate directly to the specific provisions of the statute, which in no way have been abrogated.
They don't, actually. They refer to the specific provisions of the CFR. I actually, now that I look at it, there's no statutory citation at all.
Your Honor, if you take a look a little bit further in the case, there is a reference to the statute.
There is in the case, but is there in the footnote?
In that footnote, no. It's referring to those provisions.
How is this different than the Supreme Court's opinion in Weinberger, where the court is discussing the FDA statute, which the court notes expressly states that the statute requires FDA to give due notice and opportunity for hearing to the applicant before it can withdraw its approval of an NDA, period, close quote. And then it goes on and says, nonetheless, The FDA has established regulations which require that there be a genuine and substantial issue of fact. And the court says that we've decided the propriety of such a procedure was decided in United States versus Storer. So that notwithstanding a statute that says you have a right to a hearing before a withdrawal in that situation of a new drug application, if the agency has a regulation that says you only have this right to a hearing if there's a genuine issue of material fact, that's okay.
Yes, Your Honor. That can be true with respect to the particular agency's determination. What I am pointing out here is that under the governing statutes here, in particular the Investment Advisors Act, which was, of course, discussed elsewhere in Stedman.
On a different point, though.
In the footnote, yes, Your Honor.
No, but the rest of the discussion is on a different point.
Yes, Your Honor. But the court in Stedman made clear just what are the essential issues of fact. In the other statutes that we have been looking at here in other cases, Your Honor, there was not a situation as here in which the issues presented are inherently fact-specific. And that is what we are pointing out in this case. In each of the cases cited by the SEC, there was a specific determination that was a controlling fact, and typically a single controlling fact, made by the agency and then affirmed by the court.
So you agree that if there were no genuine issue of material fact, that it would be okay under the statute and under the Constitution for the agency to go ahead and make a decision?
I do agree with that, Your Honor. However, here we have a record replete with issues of material fact. At pages 65 through 135 of the record, we have a number of affidavits that set forth some, not necessarily every bit, of what Dr. Seegers would present at a hearing before an administrative law judge. But we have ample statements of what his position is with respect to the various issues. We have investors from his hedge funds who are stepping in and saying that from their perception, Dr. Seegers did not act with a degree of scienter that would warrant his permanent bar from the industry, that there is a reasonable assurance against future violations, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, in other words, we have an ample room for factual dispute with a governing law that calls for a determination of issues of state of mind and intent. Those issues were not fully resolved by the district court in Texas. At a live hearing, I respectfully submit Dr. Seegers would have had an opportunity to present the story that has a full bearing on the specific issues that are called for by the statute here. I would add that the record inadvertently, through my fault, omits additional material of a factual nature. Dr. Seegers submitted, in fact, a witness list with a total of approximately 8 witnesses and an exhibit list with approximately 20 exhibits that I inadvertently did not include in the record here. That would be in addition to the 70 or 80 pages that were also referred to just a moment ago, and I'd be happy to, with the court's leave, to supplement the record in that regard. I would also note that the Fifth Circuit has not yet rendered its decision with respect to the appeal there from the district court decision. Now, as I would concede this to the SEC, I am not saying that they cannot present this case and have this appeal determined prior to a determination of the Fifth Circuit appeal. But here's what I am saying. Is it the best use of this court's time when the Fifth Circuit has before it an appeal that could be of very great importance here? I will argue, Dr. Seegers does want it both ways.
You don't want us to decide this appeal?
I'm sorry?
You're the appellant here, right?
Yes.
You don't want us to decide?
I do, but I would recommend this, that we await the Fifth Circuit's
decision. Have you ever recommended that before this moment?
No, I have not.
I'm afraid it's too late.
All right. That's fine, and I'm not suggesting that we...
It's so late that your red light has been on for a little while. Either of my colleagues have any further questions? If not, then we'll hear from the respondent. Don't know how the people wound up at the tables they're at this morning. We normally find petitioners on our left and respondents on our right, but we're adaptable.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Pack, and I represent the United States Securities and Exchange Commission in this matter. Basically, what we have here is a situation where the petitioner is attempting to relitigate the issues that he lost in the district court. Before the commission, Mr. Seegers identified four and only four issues that he thought warranted a full-blown evidentiary hearing. Two of those issues basically went to his argument that it wasn't my fault. One issue is he says that this activity was sparked by third-party error rather than my own deliberate actions. His second argument is that any delay was caused by the need to confer with top legal and accounting professionals who were slow in responding. So as I said, basically he has two arguments here. He says, whatever deception occurred was not my fault. Now, these two issues are issues that were resolved by the jury in the district court case and by the district court itself when it found there was ample evidence to support the jury's conclusion that Mr. Seegers had committed fraud and perforce had acted with scienter.
On the question of spark, whatever that means, I take it the SEC doesn't disagree that there was no like long-term plan here, but that this occurred when he first got information that
That's right. That was
so it's undisputed as to what sparked the problem. Is that right?
Right. There was a problem with the
third-party error,
the incorrect evaluations,
and that's not a genuine issue of material fact because you don't dispute that.
No. There's no dispute that what the record in the district court shows is that once Mr. Seegers learned of the erroneous information. Rather than cease passing on the erroneous information, he kept passing it on for another 4 months. And indeed, he sent a letter to his investors saying everything was terrific, we're doing well, when in fact he knew at the time that that wasn't the case. Because the amounts in the funds were actually much less than he had been led to believe, and he had previously led the investors to believe. I mean, at that point, at June 6th, he learned there was a problem when, to use the phrase that he employed when he spoke to his attorney about a couple months later, he said the funds are in the toilet.
What were the other two issues? You said there were four.
The other two issues are his argument that he didn't receive fees from the funds and that he suffered significant investment losses himself. And the division, the staff of the commission, before the commission, conceded.
The third one, he didn't receive.
That he didn't receive funds. That he did not receive fees for his activities regarding the funds. He said, I wasn't paid for what I was doing.
This was that he didn't profit from it?
Yes, they both go to his failure to profit. He said, I didn't get money out of this. I wasn't paid anything, and in fact, I lost money myself because I had my own money invested. And the staff of the commission, in the proceedings before the commission, did not dispute those two contentions. It conceded those two facts for the sake of the proceedings. So we are not going to dispute that Mr. Seegers didn't get any fees himself and that he lost his own money in this investment. So obviously there can't be a disputed issue of material fact when both sides agree. And, of course, these are two issues that were resolved by that concession in favor of Mr. Seegers. There are two other issues, aside from the four that he raised before the commission, that he has raised in his appellate brief. These are issues that both were not neither of these issues were raised before the commission, therefore they were waived. And in any event, as we set forth in detail at pages 27 to 29 of our brief, those two issues, even if they hadn't been waived, still wouldn't raise a genuine issue of material fact. The first of these two issues was, he says, there's a dispute as to what I intend to do in the future. The commission said there's a possibility that you'd become an investment advisor, and Mr. Seegers himself has never disclaimed that possibility. He's only, as I understand it, 40 years old. He doesn't have any other career or professional activity that he's involved in. And so, and he hasn't said, I don't intend to become an investment advisor again.
Not a doctor?
Pardon me?
He calls him a doctor. He's not.
He has a doctorate degree in, I believe it's molecular biology. He's not a medical doctor, to my knowledge. Pardon me?
So he has another profession.
He has not been active in that profession since receiving the degree, which I believe was at least a dozen years ago. The only activity he's pursued since receiving his doctorate degree is that of an investment advisor, managing investments, advising people as to their investments.
PhD looks a lot better than an investment advisor.
I
hope he's better at that profession than a lot of investment advisors.
But I said the fact is the record's clear that he's never said, look, I intend to go back to being a research scientist. I don't want to be an investment advisor anymore. He has purposefully left open the possibility that he might want to become he might want to be involved in giving investment advice again in the future. And all the commission said was, look, we think there's a possibility that he might become an investment advisor. Therefore, the bar is necessary.
What's the other one? You said there are two that he raised?
The last issue is that, so we're up to six issues now. The last one, which we address at page 29 of our brief, is the question of whether he appreciates his responsibilities as an investment advisor. He claims that there is a issue of fact as to whether he appreciates his responsibilities. However, he filed an affidavit in the district court and filed the same affidavit in this proceeding. In that affidavit, he states, I quote, I do not recognize any wrongful nature in my conduct, end quote. He also states, quote, I feel that my refusal to recognize any wrongful nature in my conduct is warranted. And so the commission's position is that this is not just sort of a litigation position. This is actually sworn testimony. He says, I didn't do anything wrong. The commission's looked at this and said, well, we think you really did do quite a bit that was wrong. And your failure to learn from this experience, your failure shows that you don't appreciate your responsibilities as an investment advisor and are not fit to be an investment advisor in the future.
You say he raised these other issues below. When I look at his petition for review to the SEC, they're actually not in it.
Pardon me?
When I look at his petition for review,
it doesn't look
as if the first four are in it.
They were presented in his brief to the commission.
Is that timely under the SEC's rule?
I believe it is. I would note that opposing counsel has conceded that, in fact, there is no right statutory under the statute or under the Constitution to a hearing where there is no issue that can be resolved by the hearing. This conclusion is supported both by a number of Supreme Court cases, by cases from at least two circuits.
I don't think you need any support.
Yes,
he gives it up.
No. And the position makes sense. If the Court has no further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll subtract it from the last case before you.
Thank you.
You were out of time. We'll give you 2 minutes back for rebuttal.
Could you just say what is your response to this point about the affidavit? In the affidavit, he says that he doesn't recognize that he did anything wrong. Well, what are we supposed to do with that?
Yes. Your Honor, that is his position before the SEC in this proceeding.
Under oath. No, it's not just
correct.
A litigation position. He says, I did not defraud the investors.
That is correct.
And there's a finding by a district court that he did. And that certainly there's collateral estoppel on, right?
As to that issue, I would say yes.
So doesn't that indicate at least some degree of failure to recognize his responsibility here?
I don't believe that he is bound before the SEC in the administrative proceeding.
By his own sworn testimony? By his own sworn affidavit?
To acknowledge fraud. I believe that he may take the position.
He could take the position, he could be silent, but how can he say I didn't do it under oath?
As to that, collateral estoppel would apply from the district court.
It says, I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct. That's not just a litigation position.
I agree, Your Honor. That in fact, is his statement of his position, his state of mind, his understanding that he did not defraud the investors. The matters that arose during the trial are complex. That is the problem here. They cannot be simply resolved by a single sweep of the pen that just adopts the district court's decision, which is essentially what the commission has done here. The administrative law judge quite literally did that. He tracked the district court decision in rendering his initial decision granting the motion for summary
disposition. You agree that a finding, like the district court's finding that he did defraud, which is the ultimate finding of the opinion, there's collateral estoppel on, right?
Yes. Now, a number of other issues of fact were raised here in opposition to the commission's motion for summary disposition. We have affidavits from several witnesses who address
You will need to wrap up pretty quickly, Ken.
Yes. They address all of the nuances that are required to be determined at this hearing, as the courts have stated repeatedly. And I would refer to pages 65 to 135 of the Record on Appeal. There are a substantial number of issues of fact.
Thank you.
Thank you.